This is Understanding Israel-Palestine Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's show. My guest today is Farah Nabulsi, the writer and director of the award-winning short film, The Present. But first, headline news. On Saturday, Israeli soldiers killed a 20-year-old Palestinian man in clashes between Israeli settlers and residents of the West Bank village of Kusra. Mohammed Farid Hassan was killed by a live bullet to his chest as he stood on the roof of his brother's home in Kusra, a village encircled by illegal Jewish settlements and outposts. The Palestinian news agency Wafa reported two other Palestinians were also shot and injured after Jewish settlers stormed the village. An Israeli military spokesman said soldiers had been trying to disperse the confrontation between Israeli settlers and Palestinians when Hassan was shot. In April, the United Nations warned of rising levels of settler violence occurring amid an atmosphere of widespread impunity. Israel detained a Palestinian human rights lawyer taking part in a protest in the occupied West Bank against Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Farid al-Atrash was stopped early this week at an Israeli checkpoint and transferred to Israel's Hadassah Hospital, where his friend Isa Amro, a prominent Palestinian activist, was recently released after detention there. Both men have been arrested often by Israel for organizing and participating in protests against the Israeli military occupation. Al-Atrash was returning from a protest in Ramallah against the Palestinian Authority. Thousands of Palestinians have been protesting the June 24th death of a well-known Palestinian activist at the hands of Palestinian security forces. As per the Oslo Accords, the PA administers parts of the Israeli-occupied West Bank and coordinates security with Israel. The Palestinian Authority security forces are being accused of targeting women journalists covering recent protests against the PA. Attacks on women journalists include physical violence, confiscation of electronic devices used to report, intimidation and harassment, arrests, and online smear campaigns targeting them on social media sites affiliated with the PA. According to news accounts, the women journalists appear to be singled out for greater abuse than their male counterparts. After more than 60 days on a hunger strike to protest his detention without charge or trial, Palestinian prisoner Ghadanfar Abu Atwan has grown increasingly weak and is unable to speak or move. He has refused medical examinations and treatment by the Israeli prison authorities and has lost more than 30 pounds. On June 10th, the Israeli Supreme Court rejected for a second time Abu Atwan's petition concerning the abolition of his administrative detention. An officer with the Palestinian Customs Police, Abu Atwan was arrested in August 2020 on secret evidence he is not allowed to know. His family say that he has been psychologically tortured and has been placed in solitary confinement, subjected to long interrogations, and physically beaten on multiple occasions. Due to severe dehydration, doctors at the hospital warned that Abu Atwan could die at any moment. After the short film The Present was released in March, it was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Live Action Short Film. It was also nominated for and won the 2021 BAFTA Award for Best Short Film, the British equivalent of the Oscars. The 24-minute film tells the story of a Palestinian man who sets off with his young daughter to buy an anniversary present for his wife. It was directed by Farah Nabulsi, who co-wrote it with Palestinian writer Hind Shofani. Born and raised in Britain, the daughter of a Palestinian mother and a Palestinian-Egyptian father, Nabulsi had taken a trip to Palestine in 2013, which changed the trajectory of her life. Previously a stockbroker and investment banker, she took up filmmaking. The Present is the fourth film she's written about life in Palestine and the first she's directed. She's with us today to talk about her life and work. Farah Nabulsi, thank you so much for joining us to further our understanding Israel-Palestine.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to ask you just a little about your background. I've read that you went to Palestine as a child, but that after the first Intifada, your family didn't return and your first trip there as an adult came 25 years later. Why did your family stop going to Palestine? What was it about the trip in 2013 that made such an impact on you?
We went many times as children. And then, of course, the first Intifada, which, you know, translates as uprising, was around 1988. And after that, I think for my parents, and we were living in England and all of that, I think there was a stigma that followed in terms of it maybe not being safe or somehow, I don't know what it was exactly, but, you know, there was suddenly less of a need or a desire to go back or to take us there. And that was it. And I don't know if it comes from a place of, you know, trauma, fearfulness, worried for their children. But yeah, we didn't go back for many, many years. And then I sort of made a decision as a grown adult that, you know, wait a second. How is it I haven't visited my blood country, if you like, in so many years? And I went. And on this particular initial trip and the trips that followed, I really had thought that I'd understood everything going on in reality there. But really, there is no substitute for seeing that very harsh reality with your own two eyes on the ground. For me, whether it was the sort of refugee camps that I visited, or the checkpoints that I had to pass through, or these illegal colonies on all the hilltops, or this horrible wall plowing through Palestinian homes and lands, and the separate road systems. Everything I sort of came across and the conversations I was having with the actual Palestinians that were suffering that injustice really overwhelmed me. And I sort of came back to what I do consider my life a privilege, comparatively so, and started to write therapeutically about what I had seen and experienced, and began to imagine, as I naturally started to exercise empathy about the injustice, if you like. And then it took me a couple of years, and I decided, wait, you know what, I want to tell these human stories, and I want to express myself creatively. And I've always loved film, and threw caution to the wind and thought, okay, I'm going to adapt these initial writings to films and produce them. And that's what I did.
The Present is a very affecting story, which shows how a man's shopping trip to buy his wife an anniversary present is complicated by the Israeli checkpoints that separate Palestinian communities from one another and make what should have been a simple journey for him long, frustrating, and both humiliating and infuriating. I'm wondering how you and your co-writer, Hind Shofani, went about writing this story. What was its genesis? Did you start with a thought that you wanted to write about Israeli checkpoints, or was it something else that started it?
The main inspiration comes from the fact that I've been at many of these checkpoints myself. So it's a personal experience in that sense. But I've also witnessed hundreds of Palestinians at these checkpoints, of which there's over 100 all over the West Bank. Again, you know, I make this point, these are not checkpoints inside Israel. These are all over the West Bank. And I've experienced them. I've witnessed Palestinians at them. But I also have a friend that I've gotten to know over the years. And he lives in an area where there's an Israeli checkpoint around 100 meters from his home. And no matter where he has to go, or who he wants to see, or what he wants to get, he has to go through his checkpoints, which is absolutely absurd. So the seed of this story actually is a conversation I had with my friend, standing, staring at this checkpoint near his home. We had just passed through it. And it's a checkpoint that looks very similar in concept to the one that's featured in the film. So it has a turnstile, it has a metal detector, because not all checkpoints have those mechanisms. And I said to him at the time, I said, okay, let me understand this. If you wanted to bring a couch, a new couch home, what do you do? And he said, you know, if it doesn't fit, it doesn't go. In theory, you're supposed to ask permission, but ultimately these checkpoints aren't here to serve us or comfort us, or they are here to frustrate. They are here to humiliate. They are here to separate us from each other and so forth. And then the conversation got even more convoluted, where I said, okay, what about a hammer? You need to do some DIY at home. That fits. He's like, are you crazy? Do you want to get me shot? Do you want to get me? They'll assume that I'm coming in with a weapon. And, you know, and it just, the conversation became so absurd. So that was the main, you know, the story came to me. And then I wrote the story. Then I wrote the first draft myself. And then I sort of turned to Hind Shofani, because I'd never actually written traditional script before myself, and said, look, are you interested in writing the story with me as an actual script? So we got going with that. When you're in the creative journey, you start with a premise, and then you build and you expand, and then you even contract, and then you add maybe more characters and so forth, just like any creative process. But the root or the seed of it was based on absolute reality and personal experiences, as well as those of people I'd kind of come across.
One of the most memorable scenes in the film to me occurs early on in the film when the father is with a crowd of men waiting to get through the checkpoint. And you see how congested it is. And you see men climbing above them along the high bars that are enclosing them all to get ahead of the queue. What they're doing looks very precarious, very dangerous, but it underscores just how crowded it is and how desperate our people are to get through the checkpoint. Could you talk a little about that scene? Was it filmed in Palestine, or was it a recreation of what you had seen there?
Yes, so that's scene two of the film, and that is actually footage of a real checkpoint. It's an infamous checkpoint in Bethlehem, checkpoint 300. I always say Bethlehem, birthplace of Jesus. Like, it's so bizarre to me. But I felt very strongly about shooting that checkpoint, and I felt that not only did we not have the budget to recreate it, but authentically, you know, I didn't feel it would do it justice if we even attempted to recreate it. That checkpoint is a checkpoint that leads into occupied East Jerusalem, and thousands and thousands of Palestinian laborers basically go through that every single day from what can be as early as sort of 2:30 in the morning all the way up till sort of 7-8 in the morning. And sometimes it can take hours to get through. And it really is a monstrous checkpoint. It's so inhumane. Clearly, the people who are subjected to that checkpoint, and all checkpoints, frankly, have not been considered in the process because, you know, like you said, you have people climbing up on the bars. It's extremely congested and claustrophobic and exhausting, and can take hours to get through. And so we went in and filmed that checkpoint kind of sort of documentary style. For me, we knew how far we could go till we came into the sort of line of vision of the military around the corner. It's a very industrial checkpoint. It's different to the checkpoint that features in the rest of the film. And it was a different experience. We went in sort of guerrilla style. The entire film was filmed in Palestine, though, and in the Bethlehem area. So that was a checkpoint that was real, that we filmed.
You've received a lot of recognition and acclaim for the present, the Academy Award nomination and the BAFTA Award. How has that changed you and what you're trying to achieve with your films? Does it give you a bigger megaphone? Has it brought you more criticism along with greater visibility?
I can look at this kind of from two perspectives. So as a filmmaker, full stop, let's set aside the subject matter for a second. As a filmmaker, these are major accolades, and the journey that got us there, and we received over 30 international jury and audience awards along the way as well. And then we get to what is considered in the industry the pinnacle, which is the Academy Awards and the BAFTAs. And as a Brit, you know, the British Academy Awards is a very big deal as well, internationally and as a Brit. And so as a filmmaker, this is wonderful. Of course, it opens up many potential avenues. At the same time, you have a subject matter that perhaps some would have considered taboo, or that surely, you know, these cannot be recognized. Palestinians are often very misrepresented or underrepresented on the big screen. And here we are with this story, with this subject matter, and also still receiving those accolades and the industry recognition and appreciation of my work, right? And this is wonderful. I was not sugarcoating anything. I told the story I wanted to tell the way I wanted to tell it. And we were received and awarded and recognized for it. And for me, that confirms that we can tell bold, unapologetic stories about the Palestinian experience, the Palestinian narrative. I think that in some ways, maybe that, yes, it does help me forge forward with the stories I want to tell, for sure. And it should help others, I hope, forge forward with the stories they want to tell, whether about the Palestinian experience or other injustices and so forth. But for me, I think it has helped. And no, it has not increased criticism at all. On the contrary, I can't complain. We've only received wonderful reactions with all those rewards on the journey and these accolades. So it means a lot more exposure as well, of course, for the film. And that is the most important thing for me as a filmmaker and as a filmmaker who's making a film that, you know, matters. I love that there's a lot more distribution and eyes on it. But, you know, I was never in it for the accolade. I was in it for, you know, people to see the film. As a filmmaker as well, you make your art so that it can be seen. And so, for example, we're distributed on Netflix worldwide. And that to me is a major accomplishment. So, you know, beyond even accolades. So I'm very happy with the outcome. And yes, it sets the playing field in a better place.
One of those accolades was from former CIA director John Brennan, who wrote an op-ed about your movie and said he hoped President Biden would watch it. I'm wondering how you felt when you learned of that.
So this came a few days after the Oscars. And, you know, I started to receive messages saying, have you seen this op-ed piece in the New York Times? And I was happy because for me, yes, it was a very interesting point of art, film, cinema, coming together with, you know, purpose and reaching in some ways sort of public opinion, and as well as obviously, yes, a very high ranking individual in the US arena government landscape. And for his piece to have been not only online, but in print, take up an entire page, have a picture of Yasmin, our, you know, one of the protagonists of the film. And yes, that big title saying why Joe Biden should watch this Palestinian movie was wonderful. And to have him name Yasmin by name and relate to her with regards to other Palestinian youth and recognizing that they have dreams and aspirations as well was a big deal. And then, of course, about a week to 10 days later, he was on Christiane and Amanpour and CNN talking about China, talking about Mexico, talking about his book, I believe, and then talking about the present. And again, he names Yasmin and he talks about, you know, these elements. And I'm not a big fan, of John Brennan on a personal level. But the fact that this conversation was happening and on such a high level in that sense is excellent. It's brilliant because ultimately I like to think of myself in some ways as, yes, a purpose-driven filmmaker. It's not just about, you know, entertainment here. It's about telling these important stories that hopefully shift feelings and perceptions. And ultimately, it'd be wonderful if elements of public policy are affected by that or governmental policy towards what is an ongoing injustice.
This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. If you're just joining us, I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to Farah Nabulsi, the writer and director of the short film, The Present, a story about a Palestinian man who sets out with his daughter to buy his wife an anniversary present. The film won an Oscar nomination this year and the BAFTA Award in Britain. I know The Present is available through Netflix. Are there other services where people can get hold of and watch The Present?
Depending where you are in the world, but sort of in the US, I believe it's available on Amazon Prime as well, or will be very soon. I think it is already. There's Vimeo on demand. Again, not 100% sure where, but I think the US as well. Outside of the US, it's Telefonica, Canal Plus, various TV stations in Japan as well. I believe it's being distributed. So it is available. You just kind of have to dig a bit, but I'd say in the US, Amazon Prime, Vimeo On Demand, and Netflix worldwide.
One of your previous films was called Nightmare of Gaza, which I read was the first film you wrote and written in response to the Israeli war on Gaza in 2014. Another devastating war that killed more than 2,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 10,000, including more than 3,000 children. Over 1,000 of them left permanently disabled. The Israeli casualties were a fraction of that, 67 Israeli soldiers killed and 6 civilians. We've just seen another war in May between Hamas and Israel. You obviously felt strongly about the 2014 war. I imagine you may have similar feelings about the war in May. In this country, there seems to have been more criticism of Israel and outcry against the war this past May than the war in 2014, even though the recent 11-day war was shorter and less deadly. Was the same true in the United Kingdom? What do you think people here and in your country should know about Gaza?
So just to correct you, it wasn't the first film I wrote. That was the third, actually. the third film I made and the third piece I wrote. And yes, I did write that 2014 as the bombs were falling. And you know, the number of children killed was around 500. And as you mentioned, life-changing injuries as well for thousands. Of course, anytime Gaza is being bombarded and entire buildings are being wiped out and entire families are being wiped out, I have the same feeling, which is this is absolutely not right. And let's not forget that Gaza has been under a brutal blockade, or as some describe as a siege of some kind, for years. I think it's we're at 14 years now, which is absolutely insane and frankly a stain on humanity to allow 2 million people to be boxed in what is described as the biggest open air prison on planet Earth, where over 50% of the population are under the age of 20. So we are talking teenagers and children. And, you know, whether it's unemployment rates being skyrocketing, whether the water is not usable and not drinkable, where the UN said come 2020, it's not going to be livable. Well, we've passed that date, and some would argue it hasn't been livable even prior to that. And so, yes, when the bombs fall, it's just not right. It's not acceptable. And the might of what is considered one of the most powerful militaries on planet Earth. So yes, it didn't last as long, but like you said, it's because in many ways, maybe the pressures came about. And yes, the reaction of the world was much faster and much more critical and much more aware. I think that a lot can happen in 6-7 years since 2014. And I think that the world community, especially after sort of, let's say, 4 years of a Trump administration, which very, very clearly showed that the US is absolutely not an honest broker in the sort of Palestine-Israel situation, and all these unilateral moves that they carried out, and the sort of fascist alliances, whether it's between sort of the Trumps and Netanyahu's and Bolsonaro's in Brazil and Orban in Hungary and Modi in India, these alignments becoming much more clear. People are standing in solidarity with Palestinians, much more recognizing that this is not what you would call a conflict. It is military occupation, and there is a occupier and the occupied. It is settler colonialism. There is the colonizer and the colonized. It is apartheid. And this is, you know, finally confirmed by the biggest, most respected human rights NGO in the world, Human Rights Watch, finally came out with the confirmation of what Palestinians have been saying for years, and what a leading Israeli human rights organization, B'Tselem, had been saying recently as well. And so now that reality, I think, is becoming clearer and clearer. And I hope that means that people will react in a way which means more action and more accountability to their own governments, who ultimately, are aiding and abetting this. So, you know, I think the landscape is changing. I think Palestine in many ways is coming more into the mainstream, and rightly so. It's been going on for decades, and it is not a religious conflict as some would like to frame it. It really isn't. There are elements of religion intertwined in this, but it isn't. And you asked me, sorry, specifically about Gaza. I mean, like I said, 14-year blockade. Okay, so what's going on in the world right now? Have I missed all the debates in Congress or in the Knesset or in the British Houses of Parliament discussing bringing that blockade to an end? Did I miss them last year, the year before that? The fact is, when everything is, and I say in quotation marks, quiet, nobody's raising a finger to end that blockade, that inhumane blockade, where people are literally being left to die slowly, whether it's through lack of sanitized drinking water over time, where disease can spread, where people are literally having their calories counted, literally in terms of the amount of food that is being allowed into Gaza. I mean, literally there are calorie counters from Israel, where they are barely able to make ends meet. Who's having those discussions? Where is that happening? It breaks my heart what's happening in Gaza. Absolutely.
Those discussions certainly are not taking place in this country. Let me ask you about something else. You have a website, oceansofinjustice.com, which is a website full of information about the injustices Palestinians have experienced in the past and today. It's very graphically appealing with lots of resources, photographs, and videos. It's really, I think, an excellent website. What led you to put together this website?
So when I started to screen my initial short films at, you know, festivals around the world and at universities, and when I say festivals around the world, I want to say primarily when I was in the US and Canada, actually, interestingly enough, and the UK, but Canada and the US, more so than Europe necessarily, what I found was I'd be doing these Q&A sessions and I'd be standing alongside other filmmakers and I'd screen my films along with these other films that are usually packaged in programs. And the Q&A sessions predominantly were I was being addressed by people more than anyone else in those panels. It was like there was a definite interest and intrigue, and it was genuine. Audience members asking me questions. Okay, well, hold on, sorry. Why was this child taken away? And okay, but why is this happening? And who, you know, questions and questions. And so what I realized is that there is a genuine interest to understand the Palestinian struggle, what's happening on the ground there, that Americans and Canadians aren't really having access to. Mainstream media in the US does not cover the reality. And you would be forgiven for believing very different things were happening if you were to watch something. I remember 2014. I was in London, of course. What was happening in Gaza? I happened to fly to New York. And you would be forgiven if you thought that two very different things were happening on planet Earth at that given moment in time. So unfortunately, there's really not that much information in mainstream media for Americans. Of course, now with social media and transatlantic media and alternative media, there are. But what I found is what there was a hunger and an interest. And 1 hour Q&A sessions wasn't going to cut it, especially when it wasn't just Q&A sessions with me alone. And I realized that it would be great to have a platform to direct people to continue to understand, to continue the conversation, to continue to have resources they can access. So put together what essentially has the name of my first film, Oceans of Injustice. And as you said, oceansofinjustice.com for people to go and have a read of. And it really just deconstructs occupation, military occupation. Again, many Americans don't understand what that even means. And the injustices, ultimately, of which there are so many that most people do not know about. I've had wonderful feedback on the back of that.
Farah, we've only a few minutes left. I understand you're working on a feature film. Could you tell us anything about it? Is it about Palestine?
I actually can't talk about it much, to be honest. But I will say that, yeah, it's my first feature film, and it's sort of a character-driven drama thriller. It is set in a similar landscape to the present, and I'm very excited about making it. And I hope you'll all be able to see it not too far away in the distant future.
Farah Nabulsi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, really.
I've been talking to Farah Nabulsi, the writer and director of the award-winning short film, The Present, which can be seen on Netflix, Amazon Prime, and other streaming services. You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine, Beyond the Walls on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Join me and co-host Jeremy Ross Cushell and Jamie Jackson again next Friday at 9:30 a.m.